against Eli Lilly and Company. Mr. Ratzak.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Ratzak. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, in this case, Catherine Albers. This is the case involving the summary judgment issued in the trial court based upon the District of Columbia's statute of limitations. The issue was whether or not the trial court properly interpreted the very broad District of Columbia statute of limitations, which, as this court is aware, is an accrual date statute that has three prongs, which involve the knowledge of the injury, knowledge of the specific cause, and then the real key here, knowledge of wrongful conduct. And that was what we believe really took this case out of the cases that you would normally see before this court, because this court, presumably in diversity jurisdiction cases, has seen cases from neighboring states where you have the first two prongs, typically, for example, in Illinois, a duty to investigate when you know of an injury, but missing that third prong, the prong that the District of Columbia stresses, which is the knowledge of wrongful conduct.
Not actual knowledge, actual or imputed. And, of course, the ground on which your client lost was imputed rather than actual knowledge. That your brief spent its whole time denying actual knowledge, but never really grapples with the question when knowledge is imputed.
We believe we've...
Your opportunity.
Thank you. We believe that what we've said is we're uncertain where the knowledge of where the fact of imputed knowledge is going to come from in this instance.
Well, anybody who did even a superficial search at the time would easily have discovered that courts had found the administration of DES to be wrongful. So the only question one would think is whether your client was on notice of enough to cause a superficial search to occur.
I agree with that. And if we look at the facts of this case, the question is, what did she have that would have caused her to suspect the wrongdoing? Because in the District of Columbia, the duty to search, the duty to make inquiry, doesn't start until you have a reason to suspect wrongful conduct, which is a relatively high bar, I would submit to the court. Wrongful conduct is generally interpreted to be a breach of a duty that's owed to somebody. And if we look at Catherine Albers, all that she knew was that she had a DES-influenced uterus. That is really all that she knew. She did not
yes.
know.
And why doesn't that induce a reasonable person to inquire whether there might be a problem? If somebody told me, actually I have been told, you're going deaf because of the administration of neomycin, wouldn't that induce you to inquire whether the administration of neomycin was a good idea?
I disagree with that. I would think I would. Your Honor said that you would. But the question here is whether or not the person who is the plaintiff would. And in that instance, we have to see whether or not a jury could decide that it was reasonable for somebody in Catherine Albert's position, or in the hypothetical, the person in Your Honor's position. Would they inquire?
Not hypothetical, either for me or for the case that, or for Mr. Kubrick, which reached the Supreme Court in 1979.
Correct. A case whose reasoning the District of Columbia has specifically rejected because they have a different statute of limitations, because they require knowledge of wrongdoing, and that's the distinguishing feature. What the duty to inquire comes not from the quantum of information that's available, but the quantum of knowledge that the person has. This person, Catherine Albers, knew she had a number of things, number of medical conditions that were making it difficult for her to become pregnant. She was told she could conceive, but it would be difficult. All she knew was that one of these multiple conditions, and I believe they're all medically set out at page 5 of our reply brief, one of these medical conditions was the shape of the uterus, which was DES influenced. She was not told that, she did not even know that DES was a drug. This is not a situation in Hartnett where the doctor said, you have something that was caused here and suggests where it should not have been caused. It's also a drug not administered to her. If somebody had given her the DES and it had caused a problem within a year or two, there might be a different situation. But we're asking that as a matter, what the trial court said was, as a matter of law, somebody whose mother got a drug in 1955 and knows no more today,
and who was told that, and who was told that it caused, in fact, a medical problem she is currently suffering. They're all agreed, right?
They are, except that when we talk about the medical problem she is currently suffering, the medical problem she was currently suffering when she had that appointment with the doctor and got that letter in 1991 is simply a condition of her uterus. At that point, she believed she could still conceive. That's what the doctors told her. She believed that there might be a problem. As a matter of fact, had she filed a lawsuit at that time, Lily would have said, "You're premature. We don't know if you can conceive or not conceive. All you can tell us at that point is that there are 7 or 8 different medical conditions, one of them possibly influenced by DES, that would in fact make it difficult for you to become pregnant. We don't know."
She wouldn't be able to file a suit until, or at least have a legitimate claim until she had passed fertility age? You mean she'd have to wait until she's old, so she couldn't conceive under any circumstance?
In this instance,
since the law treats even 80-year-olds as capable of conceiving.
That's correct. I don't think a jury would ever buy that argument, though, Your Honor, so I don't think we could win at that level. However,
but it ain't true, right?
That's correct.
Lots of these DES claims have been brought by people before they reach menopause.
Most of those claims are brought because of cancer. The DES scandal, by the way, was basically brought about...
Scandal. It was just an unfortunate consequence.
I guess the advocacy puts me on the other side of that.
But to some extent it worked, didn't it?
Yeah.
DES?
Yeah. She's here.
That depends upon which doctor you talk to.
Thalidomide is making a comeback.
That's correct. But under different doses and different restrictions. I think there's a great part of the medical profession thought DES was all but useless for what it did.
Well, there are other things that are problems there, and just conceiving. If she did have to have her cervix sewn shut, some other things like that, that certainly is... beyond the pale with regard to what might be a problem concerning it.
Except that those other problems that she had are not related to the DES. The only thing that she knows is caused by the DES is the fact that she's got that letter that said her uterus is malformed, T-shaped, because of the DES. Now, she has other things that have to be done and other problems that have to be taken into consideration, but unless we're going to hold her to the standard of a midwife or a doctor or a nurse or somebody or a lawyer, I would suspect many lawyers were this. I'm suggesting to the court that a person with all of this knowledge could still reasonably be found by a jury, and that's where we obviously disagree with the district court judge, could be found not to suspect wrongful conduct, that somebody did something reaching almost the point of negligence.
But that's not the test, as I understand D.C. law. It's not whether you, in fact, suspect wrongful conduct. It is whether a reasonable person would have been put on inquiry. That is, it's an objective versus a subjective standard.
It certainly is an objective criteria.
Okay, you agree, the D.C. standard is objective. It's not, did this person subjectively suspect?
Would a reasonable person in her shoes, but armed only with her knowledge? That I believe that's the further part of that equation that we have to look at. Would a reasonable person with her knowledge, a reasonable person, if it's every man, may in fact have knowledge of DES. Obviously the trial court judge did. He was intimately involved in the litigation years and years ago. But as a matter of fact, as time went on and her problems arose, the chances of her actually having knowledge, other than the statement from the doctor, really diminished. The bulk of the literature, the bulk of the cases occurred in the 70s.
Well, clearly she had a fertility problem, or whatever, however you want to define that.
Yes, sir.
And if she, when you continue to try to conceive, I assume isn't she under further care? Doesn't she look to other doctors, say, I've got this and this, and got all these problems? Somebody would remind her that DES is one of them? Or did she just hope for that?
She did undergo, and I believe it's in the deposition of one of the doctors, she did undergo a series of efforts to become pregnant, and they failed. But there isn't any...
Anyone ever mentioned during all these efforts that DES...
That is my point. Nobody ever told her, you have a major problem, and your major problem is your DES. All they said was you have a uterus that's malformed because of DES. And that may be a contributing factor, but we think we can have you get pregnant anyway. That's the record before this court. And if that woman is supposed to file a lawsuit under those circumstances, then everybody who has a side effect should be suspicious of the side effect and look to file a litigation.
Or everyone whose mother had DES and they didn't have a kid has a claim in perpetuity.
They have a claim until such time probably as they realistically end their fertile years, because no one's going to bring a case of...
They could be 60 years old. I just found out this was a problem. Therefore, I have a lawsuit.
And the problem with that, I think, would be that no lawyer would ever take that lawsuit, because you'd have to prove an inability to get pregnant at that point.
Well,
unless Your Honor is saying that because I didn't become pregnant 20 years ago, I missed that opportunity. I still suspect that most lawyers would think that case is not going to fly before a jury. At some point, practical analysis comes into play, even in the plaintiff's bar.
Okay.
Obviously, my entire time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Brooks.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, Counsel.
The single issue on appeal in this case is whether the district court properly determined that plaintiff was on inquiry notice of some evidence of wrongdoing by the defendant more than 3 years before she filed her lawsuit in September 2001. There are no disputed issues of material fact on this appeal, but we do know six key facts that amply support the district court's order in this case, and I'll briefly recite just those six. One, we know that plaintiff knew and was told she had a substantial permanent injury in 1991. I detect the counsel may be trying to back off the admissions that were made in the briefing and in the depositions and in the court below, but there's no question that she's admitted she was told by a medical authority she had a permanent and a substantial injury no later than 1991 that would cause her infertility, inability to carry a child to term, all those sorts of things. In fact, we have many, many lawsuits with these exact same allegations. The second key fact that we know is that plaintiff was told that her injury was caused by her DES exposure in 1991. That constitutes the first two prongs of the D.C. discovery rule, and there's no dispute that plaintiff had actual knowledge of both of those first two prongs. The third key fact we know is that plaintiff did no investigation whatsoever to look into her claim between 1991, when she learned the first two prongs, and 2000, when she says she saw an ad by a lawyer inadvertently by looking at a newspaper. She didn't push in the letter CES on the internet. She read nothing. She looked into nothing. Zero. That's undisputed. The fourth key fact we know is that plaintiff never heard or became aware of any representations about DES from Lilly or any other drug company. This is important because many of the cases where the D.C. court will extend the discovery rule on the third prong is where the defendant has made some affirmative representations to the plaintiff that their recovery is fine, there are no problems.
Would they be covered as advertising injury?
Pardon me?
Would they be covered as advertising injury?
As advertising injury?
You weren't here for the second case?
Actually, I was, but maybe I wasn't as attentive as I ought to have been, Your Honor. But there's no representations whatsoever. Plaintiff admits that. In fact, that is her claim, is that she was never told anything by any drug company or anybody else. So there is no question of reliance on any representations by the defendant or any drug companies. In fact, my fifth key fact is that plaintiff never relied on any representations about DES from Lilly or any other pharmaceutical company. The sixth key fact that's been amply established below is that had plaintiff done even a minimal investigation any time from 1991 on, she could have easily found hundreds of publications, programs, in every form of media, and we're talking the lay media, not just professional journals and such, she would have discovered the existence of thousands of virtually identical lawsuits, many of them in Illinois. In fact, on page 20 of her brief, plaintiff admits that had she looked anywhere, done even minimal investigations, she would have discovered plenty of allegations by wrongdoing.
Now, would she have to, having given that information, she would probably have, do we have to assume that she would have some sort of a heightened interest, we'll put it, that when you see an article, for instance, a long time ago, I was diagnosed with MS. Before I was, I never paid any attention. Afterwards, I looked at everything.
A lot of attention.
And I just wonder if that's an expectation, because any reasonable person who has no connection to, or his mother had no connection to DES and it didn't affect them, isn't going to pay much attention to those articles.
Probably, in fact, likely, a person that had no injury from DES and had actual knowledge of that and had no actual knowledge of its cause, they wouldn't look at those things or be as interested in the subject as somebody who had been told many years ago that they actually had an injury and it was caused by DES. The question is whether a reasonable person, having been told those things, would have looked into it further. And that's all that the judge below found. And that's a very, very reasonable finding under the circumstances of this case. In fact,
when he said a reasonable person with her knowledge, is that that a caveat that that not just any old reasonable person? It has to be a reasonable person that has some sort of a heightened reason to be reasonable, I guess.
I guess I would take issue with the heightened knowledge or heightened scrutiny requirement, because D.C. has actually rejected that type of requirement, that there's some heightened level of knowledge that's necessary. It's just under all the circumstances, whether you've been told of an injury and its cause, whether that person, under the objective standard, would reasonably have performed some sort of investigation. Now, the purpose of the third prong of the discovery rule in D.C. is to protect plaintiffs who, despite reasonable diligence, could not fairly have been expected to discover the possibility of wrongdoing. You see this in cases where the defendant has made affirmative statements to the plaintiff that have misled them from pursuing their claim. We don't have that in this case. That's been acknowledged below, that there's no representations made by the defendant. You see it in cases where the only information reasonably available is obscure and not readily available in the lay media. We've established in the record in this case that there were thousands of articles in the lay media that were available. You may see it in cases where the original injury, in combination with these other factors, was so slight or uncertain that it could hardly be considered an injury at all. I think we saw that in the Dawson case, where it was just some benign cells that the doctor said, we need to keep track of these in case they ever turn into cancer, but they never did. In no cited case, in either brief, have we seen a situation where a substantially injured plaintiff, with actual knowledge of the injury and cause, where they have not been affirmatively misled by the defendant, and where information was admittedly easily available, in no case have we seen where our plaintiff's been able to avoid the running of the statute of limitations under D.C. law. The purpose of the discovery rule is not to reward plaintiffs who don't investigate their claims. It's only to protect those who are misled or can't reasonably find adequate information when they do investigate. Plaintiff's standard would turn inquiry notice on its head and reward the least diligent plaintiff, and that's not what the statute of limitations intends to do. Plaintiff's argument that you need some quantum of actual knowledge to be on inquiry notice also defeats the whole purpose of the inquiry notice rule under D.C. law. In fact, it would be moot. You wouldn't need such a thing as inquiry notice if you always needed some quantum of actual notice before you could be put on inquiry notice. So that would just defeat the whole purpose of the statute of limitations. The Diamond case clearly says that the plaintiff has a duty to investigate and is responsible for what she could or should have found, even if she had no actual knowledge. And it rejects this some degree of actual knowledge standard that plaintiff advocates. Plaintiff in this case didn't come close to fulfilling her duty in any way, shape, or form, and it was a perfectly reasonable finding by the trial court. One final point I'll make is plaintiff relies pretty heavily on the Dawson case in her brief, and that case is easily distinguishable for several reasons. One, it was very early on in D.C. statute of limitations jurisprudence. That federal court was predicting what the D.C. court would eventually do in regard to inquiry notice. We've seen in subsequent cases under facts like these where the D.C. court routinely grants summary judgment where plaintiffs are on inquiry notice without a circumstance where the defendant has affirmatively misled them or taken steps to throw them off the track. Also in Dawson, it was a very slight possibly even just a potential injury. In footnote 2 in the Dawson case, the court clearly says that in the future, if a case comes along with a more significant injury, the analysis might well be different, and that's exactly what we've seen in the subsequent D.C. cases. Also, there were two fact questions in Dawson we don't have here. One was there was a question of fact about what representations may have been made and relied upon by plaintiff, by the drug company. And in this case, we don't have that question. We know that there were none. The other question in Dawson was a question of what information was actually available in the public domain. There was some mention made in Dawson that all there was technical literature and drug company submissions. Well, that might have been true for a plant that was diagnosed in 1973, but there's no comparison to what's available in the media now in lay publications, and we've made an undisputed record of the hundreds, if not thousands, of articles, even in the Chicago area, in Chicago newspapers and TV stations, that what was available. So in other words, what was reasonable for a plaintiff in a DES case diagnosed in 1973 is certainly not the same as what would be reasonable now with what's happened in the last 30 years. And the trial court below distinguished Dawson, and I think that is a valid comment made by the court. Yeah, that's all I have, unless there are further questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.